The 1517 Podcast Network works to declare and defend the gospel of Christ Jesus, crucified and risen for the forgiveness of sins, every day of the week.
The shows on our network are listened to millions of times a year across every podcasting platform, including the world's largest Bible app.
1517 is incredibly thankful for the work of its podcasting host and the continued support of its listeners. This year, as we celebrate our podcast, we're looking for 100 listeners to become reoccurring monthly donors of any amount.
The funds raised by this event are reinvested into our podcasts, allowing us to maintain equipment, hosting fees, and expand our reach through new marketing efforts. You can follow the link in the show notes or go to 1517.org/celebrate to support this show. Thank you. And welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I am joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and by Dr. Dan Dean. We are in our Why You Should series, and this week is the 1517 podcast celebration. You just heard a pre-roll ad that we did for that, and if you were listening to that, you know that our goal this week is to gain 100 new reoccurring donors for the 1517 podcast network. You can help us reach that goal by going to 1517.org/celebrate. We are very thankful for the supporters that we have and have had throughout the years. The podcast network is growing, and in order to continue with that momentum right now, we need to get some financial commitments so that we can reinvest into the podcast. We have some gear maintenance, some equipment maintenance that needs to be done. We have hosting fees, and those obviously grow when the network grows, and we have new marketing opportunities this year and new tools that we would like to try out, and the way we can do that is by getting some more support for the show. And so we are very grateful for anybody who commits to that this week. If you're not ready to financially support us, but you would like to help in another way, you can rate the show on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, and there are links in the show notes to those two spots. So last episode, we did a Why You Should Study Philosophy. I thought it ended up being a really great episode and conversation about philosophy and its application and its limits, and it hit a lot of points in that 50 minutes or so. And there's a little, I don't want to do an extended, but there might be an extended, that's how we do this, like a et cetera to this, because we talked, I think, very naturally about ancient philosophy, and we got to its intersection with Christian thinkers and systematicians. But there's a whole history of philosophy after, as you put it in this core reader, after Augustine, right? And it has huge implications on the world we live in, especially Lutherans can kind of see, because a lot of the time period where philosophy really starts to move and the center of philosophy, I think, shifts happens during the Renaissance Reformation or just after, the Magisterial Reformation.
Magisterial Reformation.
Mm, our listeners know that one.
Yeah. Right. And so it's kind of important stuff.
I just had 100 listeners that were like, no, I don't.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. It's kind of important stuff, and it builds up to shaping the world that we live in today, but it's also some of the philosophers to read, say, after Augustine, after Thomas. It's weighty material, and people are probably familiar with names like Kant and Hegel and maybe even Wittgenstein, but, they're probably not
hundreds
picking...
of listeners. No, I'm not.
Okay. But they're probably not picking... Not everybody, and rightfully so, is picking up these books, these works. But is there a why you should hear to being familiar with the ways in which the world, ideas, the center of philosophy, and maybe even that impacts the way we think, epistemology, religion, etc., happened after sort of this ancient era ends?
Well, and even medieval area, right? So last episode talked about Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, but then within the medieval area, talked a little bit about Augustine and Aquinas. And so now if we were kind of in the, you know, just pre-modern slash modern era, modern-ish era maybe, who should we look at?
Right. Okay. So let's pick up. Maybe we'll just, we're kind of doing a historical survey, like a quick historical survey here.
That's thinking fellow style right there.
So let's do a quick pause of the Reformation, because I think it just, since we are all Lutherans and your readers maybe are being introduced, or your readers, your listeners, are being kind of introduced into kind of the Lutheran framework of thought. I just learned this a couple years ago, but it's stuck in my craw, like something I want to kind of look into more in more detail. But because you framed it, we got the ancients, we got the medievals, and then we're going to move into kind of the early modern Enlightenment periods here in a second. But the Reformation, since you did call it also the Magisterial Reformation, was grand in a certain way, because what I didn't realize is that before Luther posted his 95 Theses, literally, I think it was 3 months, and this, I was just quickly on my phone trying to find the exact date, but it was 3 months before he posted the 95 Theses, he posts a set of theses that basically was educational reform. And his goal, and I, again, not having brought it up quickly enough here, so I'm just speaking from memory, his claim was, what we need to do is get Aristotle out of the university. We need to kick Aristotle out. Aristotle has messed everything up. So, you know, you put this in context with some of the things that Luther says about reason not being or being the devil's whore and things like this. And it's like, yeah, he had it out for these philosophers.
But you could put it in a larger context too, that Aristotle had the universities as they were prior to the Reformation reforming the universities and forming new ones. The universities as they were, and as Luther was familiar with them, were just Aristotelian.
Yeah.
They were schools of Aristotle.
Yep. Yeah, they were schools of Aristotle. And for Luther, he was mainly concerned with the fact that this Aristotelian systematics, is what I'll call it, this way of philosophizing Aristotle and combining it with Scripture and the Church, had corrupted the Church. Now, that educational theses didn't take off. So he does the 95 Theses, and as we say, the rest is history, right? And, of course, Luther says uses Aristotle in various places in his own thinking. He's not, like, against the entire set of ideas, but he was very nervous that the philosophy had crept into the theology and was...
And was had a propensity to do so.
And had a propensity to do so, and was taking away from the gospel. Mm-hmm. And if you really want to get a good sense of kind of works righteousness and you know, a kind of bad view of sanctification, you can read Aquinas and you can read Aristotle, and you'll be like, oh yeah, Aquinas' ideas were really just Aristotelian. He had brought that forward, and all of a sudden I can work my way up. So Luther throws down the gauntlet. Now, why do I bring this up? Well, I bring this up because one of the things that comes out of the Reformation was this was also the scientific revolution. Mm. Now, I've talked about the ancients in a certain way in the previous episode. Now let me put Plato and Aristotle together as more systematic, rational thinkers. They had a system of thought. Aristotle was a way of viewing the world. Plato was a way of viewing the world. And all science was done in the medieval university according to, I mean, what we would call science is anachronistic to say it was science, but we would say it was done Aristotelian. And this gets exploded when Luther says, you know what? Maybe I don't need to read Scripture through a lens of Aristotle. Maybe I can just read it as a plain text. And when he did that, he also instigated a way of now viewing the world naked. He looked at the world and said, you know what? Maybe I don't need to read the world allegorically through Scripture. So just a quick example for your readers or your listeners. The medievals thought pelicans were a sign of Christ, right? So the pelicans, and there's a church, Red Hill Lutheran in Tustin, actually has on their altar a pelican, and the pelican is beating its breast and opening its breast up, and it's bleeding into its babies. Apparently, this is what pelicans did in nature. I don't actually think, I don't know if they do this. I've never seen a pelican do this, but this was the medieval kind of, you think of medieval science, it's like a D&D dungeon manual. It's like a lot of beasts. They were literally called bestiaries, right?
Yeah.
And so when we understood pelicans as a type of Christ, you saw a pelican in the world and it stood for Christ, right? You didn't get into the molecules, the DNA, the nesting habits. You didn't care about that. It was Jesus, because it had this proclivity to care for its young by bleeding on them or something like that. Anyways, the scientists come along, though, or the proto-scientists come along after the Reformation and say, you know what? I don't have to read the world, the book of the world. I don't have to read it allegorical anymore like the way I used to read Scripture. So there was a certain way that they came to nature in the same way that Luther came to the Bible. Let me just study it for what it is. And the scientific revelation, the seeds of the scientific revolution are right there theologically. Mm. You couple this with a strong resurgence of original sin and the fact that I can't trust my senses to tell me what the world is showing me. I have to test the world because even my senses are fallen. And you've got the seeds of the scientific method being produced out of Wittenberg, Germany, right? Now, I say this because what's going to happen in philosophical thinking post medievals is you're going to get a strong divide between two ways of doing philosophy. There's going to be a very empirical bent. Who follows the Reformation? Francis Bacon, René Descartes, David Hume, right? And the last two that I just mentioned, René Descartes and David Hume, they are the epitome of kind of these two styles of thinking about philosophy. I'm going to do it according to empirical method, David Hume, or I'm going to do philosophy according to a more rationalistic, systematic approach, what you might consider more like mathematics in René Descartes. And interestingly enough, David Hume comes from Protestant country. René Descartes comes from Catholic country.
Hmm. Wow. I wonder if there's a coincidence.
I never, here. Yeah. Well, now, we can get into it, but even Descartes' method is just crazy to me.
But it's authoritative and axiomatic.
Sure, absolutely.
Right? And whereas David Hume is going to be, you know what, I can't trust my axioms.
Right.
I just got to explore and observe and think about the world through my empirical method.
You get the worst of the best.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, you get Hume saying almost to the point where you can't really know anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
But testing everything, which is great.
Right.
And then you get Descartes saying, I can know anything, just lock me in a cellar somewhere and I'll think it all up.
Right. So you get these two kind of now strands that have their roots in Plato and Aristotle.
Right.
They have their roots back there in the ancient world.
You can't get away from Plato and Aristotle.
You cannot,
in philosophy.
That's right. As Alfred North Whitehead says, all of philosophy is really just a footnote to Plato. Yeah. Right. And here it is post-Reformation. What the Reformation threw in there was the freedom to explore my world now according to human means.
Mm.
And post-Reformation, these categories of the rationalist and the empiricist, now, I probably should define those a little bit.
Definitely.
The empiricist, and I am, because I'm a philosopher of science by training, I'm always thinking about these a little bit more epistemically versus metaphysically or whatever. I'm thinking more of these like how we know stuff. Things in the world. How do I come to my knowledge and how I come to
my
beliefs?
To me, all philosophy is epistemology anyway, go for it.
Well, I think it's probably one of Luther's great additions to the philosophical dialogue is to recenter us on epistemology and not something grander like a metaphysical scheme of the world or something like that. But you get René Descartes, who is the ultimate rationalist. And why is he a rationalist? Knowledge comes from the mind. Knowledge comes from thinking.
It's an exercise.
It's an exercise in thought. You have ideas that are in your head without experience. And the only one that is certain, the only knowledge you can have that is undoubtable, the funny kind of Elmer Fudd word, indubitable, the only indubitable truth is I know that I exist. You cannot doubt that you are existing while you are thinking. Now, most
and
people,
along comes the Matrix.
It sounds like Augustine and prayer, to be honest with you.
Okay. I don't know much about Augustine on prayer, but...
It's a very similar sort of... If you run into a problem, the answer is, instead of meditation, self-thinking, it's sort of aligning yourself, aligning your thought with God via...
Sure.
And then the means is prayer. And that's how you can sort of get cooperative with God or get in on this plane where you know something finally is by submitting through prayer.
Right.
So it's worth telling the listeners that he was so committed to this that when he wrote Sacred Meditations, it comes out as a result of him literally locking himself in, you know, the pre-modern equivalent of a sensory deprivation chamber.
So you guys are theology scholars here, right?
Sure.
So what was the Catholic Church's number one critique of what would happen if they let Luther get away with what he was trying to get away with?
People are going to fornicate.
Okay. So you went ethical. I'm thinking more epistemological.
Oh, is that the church would no longer be the center of authority?
The church would no longer be the center of authority, and it was just going to fragment.
Yeah, it's
just going to fragment.
Radical Reformation gone wrong, right?
They were right, right?
Remember
I mentioned Descartes comes from a Catholic background. So what's Descartes' biggest concern? The fact that all knowledge has now fragmented. Yeah. And so what he does is he literally locks himself in a room up in a cabin somewhere. I forget where it was.
My recollection is it's they call it a stove, but if you sort of understand sort of the heating apparatus, this would be like a porcelain dome that's probably sizable enough for him to get into it without doing contortions.
This is like a what's the deprivation chambers that these weird people in
Laguna
Beach do?
It's a modern equivalent of a sensory deprivation chamber. He's trying to lock out sound.
Right.
Even vibrations from the ground, because this would have been like a brick line thing.
Right. And his famous argument for why we can know that we exist just by thinking is the evil genius, he says, I know it's going to be hard to kick God out of the equation. So it's hard to think that God's not here and doing something in this world. So he says, imagine God's actually just an evil genius. And imagine God is forever and forever tricking you in your beliefs. So everything you see is actually a trick, not even a test, but just like God's malicious. It's like
the ultimate trying to steer you wrong.
Jackass video or something. Right. You know, if you guys know what that is, these prank shows. It's like the ultimate prank show, right? Everything you're walking around in this world is false. So even your knowledge of 2 + 2 = 4, you know, mathematics has been this bastion of rationality. Even things like 2 + 2 or 4 are literally false because God is deceiving us in our ability to do mathematics or something like that. But
sounds like a fun existence.
Right. Yeah. But he comes to this point of reason where he says, but think about that for a second. If you're thinking about this very exercise, even if God's tricking me, I'm still thinking. So the firm foundation of all understanding, what's going to fix the fragmentation of knowledge for Descartes, is not my experience of the world, but my ability to think about the world.
Yeah.
Okay. My ability to think. So I think, therefore I am. You know, cogito ergo sum, or cogito sum as it is in the meditations. And that is now, for Descartes, that's where all philosophy, all knowledge, all thinking begins. Right? Problem. Who's not accounted for in that equation, except as an evil genius?
God.
God, right? So Descartes then says, okay, he gets nervous, and the Catholic Church had just had a problem with another kind of crazy person over in Italy called Galileo.
Nut job, really.
So, you know, the Catholic Church Descartes being a good Catholic is a little nervous that this is problematic because God is no longer the center of my universe. Now, isn't that interesting? Because what was God in the medieval universe? The center.
Right.
That is the God-intoxicated age. So here comes a Catholic, not a Lutheran, a Catholic, who now pushes God out to the side, and it is man who is the center of knowledge.
Well, in the center of being.
The center of being. Now, he brings God back in. He brings God back in the third meditation. He's got a famous ontological argument that we don't have to get into because you've probably got apologetic shows on it. So he does bring him back in. But he set the stage. Descartes becomes the new Plato. Descartes is the new Plato. How do I know my world? I just think about it really hard.
Yeah.
And we create
a picture of a good world, create a picture of a right world.
This gets really weird later on in history.
Right? And I mean, it does.
I mean, Caleb mentioned Hegel.
Yeah. This is what we call the rationalist turn. And it's rationalist because you're doing it completely without having to experience the world. It's completely and utterly by thought.
Yeah.
That's going to unify
knowledge. No need for external verification. No need. The only thing that's really necessary is that you can make a quasi internally consistent argument.
That's right. So if you link back to your epistemology show, I'm sure you talked briefly about coherence. Descartes is the ultimate coherent theorist, right? As long as my system is coherent, it is true.
Yeah. Right?
Now, he wouldn't say it that way, but that's what we get. All right, so we got Descartes. He's ushering in this kind of very curved inwards way of understanding the world. Move to now David Hume. Now we move to Protestant country. So it's actually the Wild West, Scotland. is the Wild West of thought.
Constantly changing hands in struggle between Protestant and Catholic and a lot of bloodshed and over maintaining a Protestant land.
Yep. So in walks David Hume, and David Hume says, you know what? This idea that Descartes has is great, I guess, but I don't know if I could ever know that it's actually true. Like, if I really look inside, it doesn't seem like thought can give me an external world. I don't see how that works. Yeah. I don't see how
you're already a member of the external world. How is that not influencing thought?
How is it not influencing? It really is hard for me not to think the world is impinging on me, not me thinking externally to the world. Like the world is, my sense data is coming. I'm seeing, I'm smelling, I'm hearing. Like that's happening to me. It's not the other way around, right? And Descartes had a neat way of trying to solve that problem. Interestingly enough, he had to borrow categories from the ancient world. We don't have to go into it. But Hume comes along and says, okay, here's how I'm going to fix the problem. When I actually look into the world, I think my senses, although fallible, are the way I take in data. I don't really come to know things by sitting in my office and just thinking about them. I got to go get my hands dirty.
In fact, I'm actually thinking about things that I've come to know by experience.
By experience. I have to go experience it.
Right. And so if I would have lived my whole life, if that were even possible, which it's not, but if that were even possible in this furnace, you know, separated from all external sensory data, I would not even have the ability to come to these conclusions because I wouldn't actually have learned anything.
I mean.
And I have no way to check or double check or whatever, the whether who's right.
Yeah. Well, and even apart from, I mean, this is empirical too, but there's been some observation of like nonverbal groups of children and things like that, and that without external influence of language, that even thought is something totally different than with the presence of a learned, experienced language and culture group and all these types of things.
Yeah. So for Hume, he comes along and explodes the rationalist paradigm and says that's got to be false. The way we learn is through experience of our world. There's
living.
Living. There's a way we can check each other on that. Am I seeing the same thing you're seeing? Or, you know, basically, where it really comes to a head is Hume didn't think we could ever penetrate the internal, essential, metaphysical truths of reality. All I have is what I experience, and I have to systematize and make sense of that experience, even though it's always and forever going to be incomplete. For somebody like Descartes or a rationalist, you have some sort of a priori before experience, some sort of internal sense of what the truth actually is. And, you know, maybe this relates to presuppositionalism, evidentialism, and apologetics, but I have some sort of sense of the way the world actually is, and then I build out the world from that sure sense of what everything, of the truth of everything.
Right. This is, I mean, not dissimilar from sort of, I don't know if I'd call it an argument, but the argument between Plato and Aristotle regarding the forms, right?
Right.
So Plato's ideal world is created essentially in his head, the world of the forms, and nothing here that you know is real. The real is up there or down there or wherever it is in the forms. And when Aristotle comes along, he doesn't necessarily disagree with that, but it's more of a, but we can't actually know anything about that because that's not where we are.
You can't have a perfect form of a chair if you've never sat in one before. But
The focus then becomes on the chair, not the form of the chair. Or how do you teach somebody about the perfect form of a chair? Well, you've got to start with the chair that's in front of you.
And you got to build from that, you know. And interestingly, the kind of disconnect between Plato and Aristotle was over causation in this way. Aristotle was, because he did have a very practical bent to him, was concerned with the fact, well, if these forms are governing everything, how do they cause all this to happen? You've given me no causal story to say how the form of beauty makes beautiful things.
And then you get Aristotle's causes, which, you know.
Yeah, cause a bunch of problems.
Cause a bunch of problems.
A few problems right. even within Lutheranism.
Yeah, that's right. And so Hume becomes basically the flag in the ground for radical like empiricism.
Okay,
the senses are.
I think
it's
important to say that he's now talking about radical empiricism.
Correct.
Because there's a way in which you know most Western people are empirical.
Mm-hmm.
We're so influenced by science and technology and all this other stuff that it's very difficult to not have an empirical bone in your body, right, in the West.
Right.
But what you're talking about is like he's the extreme
yep.
version of this.
Yeah, he's gonna drive his empiricism. So maybe we could put it this way, kind of. Descartes drives a empiricism to defeat skepticism. By I think, therefore I am.
Rationalism, too.
Rationalism, yeah. Hume drives empiricism to inculcate a skepticism. Like, he is the radical skeptic. Like, there's what eventually happens and why people end up kind of turning away even from Hume is he is so skeptical about what I have to be able, everything I say I know, I have to have some sort of empirical observation attached to it, that something like causation now becomes a figment of imagination.
Right. Because so you can't actually observe
you can't
the gravity.
Actually that, observe yeah. the causal forces of reality. I see effects, so I'm assuming there's something called a cause, but I don't actually, and this is, sounds weird, I know, but this is like the game of the philosopher, I don't actually experience cause. Yeah. The effects happen.
Yeah, you experience effect. You don't experience cause.
And so for Hume, causation becomes a complete and utter psychological phenomena. It's an association of constant conjunction is the way he says it. So I've gotten so used to experiencing two billiard balls hitting each other that the next time it looks like it's going to happen, I'm willing to bet that when ball A hits ball B will move. But there's no logical connection that would suggest in the rationalist sense that ball B has to move when ball A hits.
Right. And if you, before our listeners' brains explode.
Yeah, that was rough.
Right? a simple way to explain there's no reason to believe that it'll always happen. I mean, there's multiple like very complex sort of physics ways that you could explain why it doesn't always have to happen. But a simple way to explain why it doesn't always have to happen if somebody could reach your hand down at the last second and stop it.
Right.
Right. And this is the point. This can get like really like mind twisting, but there's also always sort of an easy way to explain his sort of doubt. Mm-hmm. Right.
There and could be intervention.
At the end of the day, I've always thought with Hume that he's warning us against extreme assumption that we make all the time. This is why I like the analytic people. At the end of the day, we make those assumptions because our experience tells us to, right? You could even use, and has been used, the sun coming up every morning,
right?
You assume it's going to come up tomorrow morning. Well, why? Well, because all of your previous experience tells you that it's going to.
Right.
But something could happen which would prevent this from happening tomorrow.
Yep.
And so you can't say definitively the sun will come up tomorrow.
Right.
Now, you can say, I think where the correction to this is, you can say, the sun's going to come up tomorrow, you know. And if you want to be real careful in your empiricism, you can say, I'm reasonably sure that the sun is going
to
come up tomorrow.
Right. Yeah, a friend of the show, the one that Montgomery likes, John Warwick Montgomery likes to use all the time is, you know, the farmer and the chicken. So it's farmer, chicken, farmer, chicken, farmer, because the farmer's feeding the chicken. Farmer, chicken, farmer, chicken, farmer, chicken, farmer, dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not the farmer died, but the farmer kills the chicken. The chicken's expecting more food. Chicken's dead because that's the past is no indication that the future
events
is going to follow that path.
You hear this warning anytime you hear an investment commercial.
Yeah, right.
Past performance is no indication of future
gains.
Gains. And we've learned about that in the crypto market over the last 4
well,
months.
Well, I haven't since I pulled the ripcord on that about a year ago.
But the reason I bring this up and is kind of like the continuation of the philosophical story is we are now really, we're much closer to where we are in the 21st century in terms of just the, I would call it the background culture of thought that is in, you know, the 21st century American life, and I'm assuming European life as well, is you're going to order your thinking and order the way you think about issues in your life either a little bit more Humean or a little bit more Cartesian.
Yeah.
You're going to be a little bit more...
Do you think we're seeing that distinction more, like even in the last 10 years, as like we had a technology boom, right? Mm-hmm. And not just in the abilities of technology, but let's say technology access, right? Like you go from computer to everybody has like the best version at any given time, right? And so there's like what we were talking about, sort of a natural empiricism in that. I think it seems to me now, though, that in political or ethical discourse, that there is a sort of rise of rationalism in considering apart from experience and maybe like a right and wrong or consequences, that there are other things to consider, that if you stop and think, like human sexuality would be one where this seems to be, I don't want to blown right open, right?
Wow. What?
Or pour somewhere where that Japanese whiskey.
Oh, okay. I guess I could just say sex. I mean,
well, this is good. We can play with this idea. So this is going to be the background water that kind of the mind is being developed through education, through home life, right? I mean, I'll use my wife as an example because I know she'll never listen to the show and won't take umbrage with it. She's a super planner. So, like, for trips.
She might take umbrage with it if she listened to the show, but she's not going to listen to the show. Thus, she won't take umbrage with it.
I got five kids, so I got a lot of kids. And so, like, we drive to Minnesota to visit family, and she has got, like, she is like Descartes. I mean, it is a mathematical formula. It is a priori, and she's got the equations.
This is most certainly true.
Yeah. It works beautifully, right? Yeah.
You end up stopping at all the right times.
That's right. She's never out of gas. She's got the time laid out for when the kids can get out and go to the restroom.
This is exactly how our 3-week road trip went with your kids.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. So, but that's just like, that's her proclivity in that context, right? I would be like, let's just load up and, you know, okay, there's a McDonald's, let's get some food and then we'll keep driving. No, you got to pee, you got to wait,
I'll look at the gas tank and when it starts getting low, I'll start looking for gas stations.
It's kind of I wouldn't necessarily call it empirical, but it's a little bit more not mathematical way of doing it. But this is the backwater that we're in. So you'll find yourself at certain times in your life kind of doing the more empirical approach, doing the more rational approach. Now, this gets... this makes people nervous because these guys were making bold claims. This is the way it has to be. And remember, we're on that cusp of the scientific revolution. The science is coming on board. Philosophy is actually now going to start taking a back seat to the rise of the sciences. But you've got this one last figure who will get us to the kind of into the Enlightenment, into the 20th century then after that. In the name of Immanuel Kant.
So you're going to say Kant.
And Immanuel Kant is going to take these two guys and merge them.
Okay.
He's going to take, he sees good stuff in Descartes. He sees good stuff in Hume. He's scared of Hume. Hume rises him from his slumber because in Hume, he's like, well, shoot, if Hume, it makes causation psychological, what else goes? And we could get into conversation there. We have Hume to thank for kind of the ethical emotions as ethics move. He's very, and Hume is another famous phrase of his, is reason is a slave to the passions, mm-hmm. right? Because if you're taking that really empirical stance, there is no such thing as morality except insofar as I feel gross when something happens or I feel good when other things happen. So he's not quite a...
It's the results of your actions sort of personally or right. even communally maybe.
And we'll systematize it as a community, right? Yeah. We'll do that. And this is where you'll get...
Or you could test, it's like, you know, if 80 people have a gross reaction and 20 people really like it, you've got to go with the 80.
That would be kind of like, that kind of thinking is now coming on board. Like that's coming down the pipeline because Hume grounds moral thinking in the emotions. And where else does he have to ground it? He doesn't have any a priori truth. He doesn't have any truth that is authoritative in that normative way, in that way that's like, this is the word of God. Mm-hmm. Because what's the word of God going to be? Well, it's just going to be a bunch of humans that were writing about their experience, right? He doesn't actually say that, but that's the kind of line he would take. So Kant says, well, this is problematic. Let's systematize all of this. And what Kant does, and this is coming, he's coming out of a I don't want to say a good Lutheran pietistic family, but he is a Lutheran pietist. you know, the Lutheran philosophers have a bad track record. We got Kierkegaard, yeah. We got Kant, we got Hegel. It's like, wow, couldn't we just get one of the cool guys?
Can we just stop? Could we get one?
I guess some people think Kierkegaard's cool, and I guess maybe, but he basically synthesizes it all, and he's got a very elaborate system that I'm not going to get into details with because it even bores me.
Wow, that's saying something.
I know. It's always it really stinks because we end our semester with Kant, and it's like I'm always like, this is the worst thing to end with. Like, we should be going out with a bang, but we're ending out with Immanuel Kant.
Yeah, you should start with Kant.
Yeah, right? But his big move was to suggest, and I mean, this is important maybe for your listeners who are in the apologetic world. When you get to transcendental arguments from the presuppositionalist side, they're ripping this straight from Kant. What Kant basically argues is that there's certain things that we know that are synthetically a priori. I can't do this without my blood pressure rising.
Duly noted.
but what Kant basically does is he put together two words that shouldn't go together. A synthetic statement is a statement that's about the world.
Empirically
verifiable.
Verifiable.
Yeah, you guys probably actually hit these sorts of statements. Yeah. At least
we
the synthetic
have in
statements,
older episodes,
and the a priori type statements. So he takes two statements that shouldn't go together, and he puts them together.
And a priori is
one that comes without experience. Right. So a classical a priori statement would be like 2 + 2 = 4. I don't have to experience the world to just see the relationship. Or the one we like to use in the analytic philosophy is all bachelors are unmarried men.
Because it's definitional.
It's definitional, right? It's axiomatic. You don't have to actually, as long as you know the definitions.
You can't argue with it. If you speak the language and somebody has told you the definition of a bachelor, it's just what it is.
Right. So basically what Kant kind of said, and I'm going to say it,
until 2020. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, right. I'm not going to explain myself too much on it because it's just a weird idea, but it makes some sense if you get into his system of thought. But he basically says something like causation is a synthetic a priori statement. Why? Well, causation has to be something that's true about my world in order for me to recognize it, but I don't learn about causation until I see it. Now, like I said, I don't want to... So causation is a transcendental category.
It's got to be there.
In order for me to even think and recognize causation, it already has to be part of the world structure, but I would never know it's part of the world structure until I see something causally happen.
Through experience.
Mm-hmm. So it's an a priori category.
I never struggled with this as much. Because
you're just a genius.
No, I'm maybe just wired this way is what I've always thought. I struggle with this a lot less than Descartes. Just saying that, I guess, is more accurate. I think part of what's going on here is he's saying, and by transcendental category, causation is something that is. You can almost just say it that way, right? It just is.
Yep.
It just is, right? And you have to take that as a priori, right? You have to assume that it just is because all of your experiences in the world tell you that it is. And so you are kind of getting Descartes and Hume here because causation is, well, how do you know that? Well, because it has to be or else I wouldn't witness these things happening. So there is sort of a real deductive move in there, but it's a deductive move that's sort of verified by constant experience.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's instead of being axiomatic, it enters the realm of universal experience, not even near universal. Right, because that's some things we go, they're nearly universal experiences, and so we have a law.
And Dan can correct me, but the problem I always see with Hume, so this is either a fast forward or just something they need to go back and listen to. The problem I see with Hume is there's just a, so in modern terms, if you're sort of doing the analytic move within synthetic statements, you could easily say, well, if you're asking me if I know that, as you would commonly know, say the word know to mean like 100% certainty of it, no, I don't, but I can operate as if it is because of probabilities. The issue that I always feel like comes in with Hume is it's not that he gets rid of acting on probability. It's just it just doesn't mean that much to him. And that's how you kind of get to the skepticism of radical empiricism that's connected to him.
Yeah.
I think there would be, and there probably is, it's been a long time, but an acknowledgement that you have to act on these things that you experience because you have no other option.
Yeah, yeah. Hume's famous, the famous phrase he has. Somebody, I don't know if it was in a correspondence with him or he put it into the end of his book, A Treatise on Human Understanding, I believe, where somebody, and again, I'm actually working on knowledge from Dr. Rod Rosenblad, who used to tell this, at least if my memory's not failing me, where somebody actually wrote him a letter and said, "Well, Hume, how do you like live? Like, how do you actually like
that's my point.
Survive?
And you just do."
And what he said was, and this is telling, he said, "Well, at the end of the day, I close my book and I go out to eat with my friends and I play a game of backgammon or something like that." So he recognized that what he was doing was a highly academic.
I think back in the day, Rod used to say, "Have a drink and light a cigarette," because that's the things he liked to do.
That's what he liked to do. Yeah, that's his experience. But the piece that I think is important, just to kind of see what happens with this move, because Kant becomes the figurehead of the Enlightenment. He actually writes the article or the essay called The Enlightenment. So he kicks off what we have inherited, even with like the founding fathers and the Constitution. Like that's, we're at that stage in history and the philosophical thought that's happening. Kant, what he did was he gave the mind, he called it his Copernican Revolution in philosophy. And his Copernican Revolution in philosophy was the fact that every person previous to him, the mind was passive. The mind was just something that received information. So think of even like Hume. It's just a receptacle that's receiving experience. For Descartes, it's
thus he can't make any conclusions.
What?
Thus he can't make any conclusions because it's just receiving.
Yeah, he's just receiving. Yeah. And the same thing with Descartes. Same thing's happening there. It's just receiving. You're just a vehicle of thought, but you're not receiving.
You're not a producer, though.
You're not a producer. And so Kant's Copernican Revolution was to say the mind is actually active in knowing and understanding the world. Now, that doesn't sound like whoa, but it was what he meant by that was.
Not to the modern person, it doesn't.
Right. Yeah. Well, the mind was actually part of the constructive process of knowing our world.
Yeah.
And so this is the place where now Kant gets, I mean, again, probably not what he would want to suggest, but this is where we are going to get now a route to postmodernism.
Well, because I was just thinking as you said that, right? Like
radical
power.
Empiricism. We're going to get a route back to all the categories that we just thought we were trying to get at, because now the human mind is actually an active participant in knowing our world and constructing our world.
I mean, you can see the clear path down to some of like the power dynamic philosophy we do now, right? Where it's about who used, like whose mind, who or which group of people's minds were creating the world we live in. Uh-huh. And is that the one we should settle for?
Right.
Should we tear it down and recreate? Should we reject, kind of thing?
So Kant, very interested in truth, but he gives this kind of active participatory view of it where the mind is actually part of the participating. It's almost like this is going to offend readers who maybe know more about this than I do, but it's almost like a process theology or process thought where it's like you're participating in the God acting in the world versus, again, receiving the benefits of God's grace or something like that. But Kant cared about truth. I'm going to draw this into the analytics now. Cared about truth, but also opened the door to the fact that the mind is more active in the production of truth than just receiving the truth or investigating the truth. So you do get the classic split, and this is rubbing roughshod over a lot of the details, but now you've got the setup for the classic split between the analytics and the continentals. And I just go this route because you brought it up, Caleb, where you've got in the continental tradition, a very immense concern with who's controlling the narrative, whose narrative is it, who's got the power. And when you read the Foucault and the Derrida, it's all about trying to reduce something down to some sort of unit of power.
Dynamic of power.
And that's very...
That needs to be deconstructed.
That needs to be deconstructed so we understand it or whatever.
And before they ask what comes in its place, of course, another dynamic of power.
Right.
But once you've reduced that and recognized that, that then needs to be deconstructed.
Right. And so,
well, it's a cycle, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a cycle of power, revolt, the revolution gains power, and then a new revolution has to come up.
Like a Hegelian way of synthesis, antithesis. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis, right? There is all that is now on the table. But you get out of, then, say, England and Scotland, you get a kind of analytic philosophy developing where they maintain that truth part of it, And they say, you know what? Actually, philosophy is about kind of aiming at truth, and you will get the rise of the John Lockes and the, you'll still get empirical and rationalist thinkers. I can't quite actually think of a rationalist out of the modern and postmodern English world. But you're going to get what eventually becomes known as analytic philosophy, where the sin of analytic philosophy is everyone, it's just logic chopping.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we're not trying to get to a power dynamic. We're just actually trying to make sure the statements that we say are true. Right. And how do they connect to our world outside of us?
And verifiable.
And verifiable. Yeah. And so you have that with Kant, you have now
the... But with language.
But it focused on language, because language is going to be the vehicle of truth.
Right.
You know,
or sort of realizing...
Because none of it matters unless it can be communicated.
Right.
Or realizing that there are categories. Like, there is a rationalist type of language, axioms. Mm-hmm. There is an empirical type of language, synthetic statements. And then there's other filler language.
Yeah, yeah. So you'll get the rise of...
Filler language.
You'll get the rise of a Wittgenstein who's going to give us that famous phrase, language games, that maybe some listeners have heard in various contexts. Mm-hmm. You'll have, like, a mathematical... game, right? Here's the rules of the game we play mathematics by. Here's the rules of the game that we do descriptive language by. You've raised before in just passing conversation the kind of ordinary language philosophers and speech act theory. All that's now part of that analytic tradition that's more geared at trying to figure out what the truth of the statements are versus the power dynamic behind the statement or something like that.
Or the ethical nature of the statement.
Or the ethical nature,
yeah. Doesn't matter who's wielding the language.
Right.
We can get to the bottom of what that is.
Yep. And so that's where, if we're doing like now this almost this radical history, that's the world that any of your kids going into college, you know, they're stepping into this kind of milieu that is post-Kant and is kind of structured around these two power divides now, the kind of analytic tradition, the continental tradition. Think of the stuff that we hear about critical race theory. That's a very kind of continental-ish way of understanding the world.
Hegelian schemes, maybe a Marxist schemes.
Yeah, all that it plays on that end of the that side of the equation.
Deconstructive.
And then you've got kind of more I would call them the scientific philosophers, natural philosophers are doing that more kind of standard analytic game where truth is still the goal, and they're kind
of...
Your feelings don't matter, and they're trying to parse...
In fact, they may be nonsense.
Yeah, they could be nonsense. The way it was described to me once was, all you really want to do is provide the, you know, I was compared to the side of a cereal box, right? The front is all flashy, but the side of the cereal box gives you all, like,
the facts.
You know, that's what the analytic philosopher is looking for, is just the facts.
The joy kill.
The joy kill, yeah. And that's the world we're in, and it's played out in interesting ways in the popular world, the cultural world, with you know what's happened over the last 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, even with again critical race theory, vaccine stuff happening, and yada yada yada.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because we talked I don't even know how many episodes ago, but with Adam about sort of great men in history, because he was talking about modern historical method.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for the listener, why any of this gets relevant is because you can see a handful of great men, whether they were crazy or sane or not, however you want to deal with that, who through one book or another actually end up shaping the way you talk and interact with the world, whether you kind of know it or not.
Right.
Is just interesting to be aware of that.
Yep.
That's interesting. Yeah, one of the names you probably will hear more in the future is this time. Well, two of the names maybe Dan brought them up as you study this period in history that aren't talked about much now outside of pointy-headed nerd circles, but might be later would be like Foucault and Derrida, because of the influence they've had on how we operate now.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, and for me, and this is kind of like, you know, again, my message as a philosopher who's Christian, a Christian philosopher, is, again, and I say this tongue-in-cheek, St. Socrates, we should be skeptical of all this.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Like, we shouldn't allow these systems, whether you're going to go down the kind of, calcium content path of the cereal box, the analytic, or whether you go down the power struggles of Foucault and Derrida and things like that. There's going to be some truth in all of it, and I'm not saying that in like a hippie way.
No, that's true.
There's going to be some truth in all of it.
Yeah.
But the problem is we as humans tend to zero in on what might be good and just push that right to the top, and we're going to make everything fit that ramshod versus stepping back and saying, yeah, I don't really know. Like, I should read Foucault. I should read Foucault. I've tried. It's impossible.
Yeah, Derrida is a mess too.
This might upset some of your readers, but I've also tried because Jordan Peterson comes up all the time in conversations. And I, when he was first getting very popular, I said, you know what? I'm going to read this guy's scholarly work.
Yeah, but you went to Maps of Meaning.
I went to Maps of Meaning.
12 Rules.
And Maps of Meaning is a bloody mess, and it makes no sense.
I think you're the one
whatsoever.
That told me. I actually read it and was asking you about it. And you're like, I can't.
I can't.
That.
I read five paragraphs and said, I am out. Because he does trend a little bit more on that side of the equation.
The Hegelian side.
I don't even know what the appropriate word is in the academy anymore. The postmodern side, the existential side. I don't know what it actually is
anymore. I think Hegelian, like in Maps of Meaning, I mean, obviously it's called Maps of Meaning. So to say that it's not Hegelian is, what are you doing there? But I do think it's overall. And we didn't do a show on existentialism, but overall, there's just like a heavy existential hand going on there.
Mm-hmm.
As I think about closing in as a title and such, it's almost a why you should care about the history of ideas, because you know, I don't know if everybody needs to go read all of this, right? Like you said, you even thinking about Kant here, you're saying your blood's boiling, you're gonna hit your head against the wall, so.
And that wasn't even before you. That was before he was thinking about Foucault.
Yeah, that was before he was thinking about. And you like this stuff, right?
Yeah.
But there is a certain level of like being aware of how the world you live in got here. It might help you see when those things are unfolding again, and when to maybe just live your life, right? Like maybe when to just sit down and play backgammon.
Right. And in the kind of combative spirit of philosophy and the argument in the culture wars that we're a part of, even just reaching back into that Augustinian notion that's missing from all of these systems, that idea of forgiveness.
Yeah, no kidding.
That is not there.
Yeah.
And again, like when I see this unfold, you're like, we're just playing. There's nothing new under the sun. We're playing the same games with maybe a more sophisticated language, maybe not. But the one piece that constantly gets thrown out the door is that thing that Augustine found that is nowhere else.
Well, the uniqueness of the gospel, right?
The gospel for Hume, it would be unverifiable.
Sure.
And for Descartes, it would be, you know, just what internally not consistent.
Yeah, maybe this is why you should know philosophy won't save you, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, this is... this helps set up human history as needing to come to an end in Christ.
Yeah, is forgiveness more than emotion?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's the problem, right? That's the problem for the empiricist there. Is it just more than an emotion?
Yep.
Amazing. Cool, guys. This is a lot, but it's I think it's good, and I think I love where it ended up.
Yeah, these were fun.
Thank you for coming on the show, Dan. Two for two is great.
Yep. And I will try never to talk about Kant again.
Until next semester.
Until you ask me about it. Yeah. I have to do it for my job, but I get paid for that. This is just, I'd rather talk about other fun things.
Yeah. Well, if you enjoyed this episode of Thank You Fellows or you're a longtime listener, we could use your support. This is 1517's podcast celebration week. You can go listen to some of the other shows as well. We are all sharing a goal this week to get 100 new reoccurring subscribers or donors across our network. And like I said at the beginning of the show, those funds that come from reoccurring gifts are used to reinvest into the podcast network into some very tangible things. And the network has been blessed with a lot of momentum and growth as of late, and we would love to continue to build on that and strike while the iron is hot. And if you would like to help us fund those projects forward, you can go to 1517.org/celebrate. And again, if that's not in the cards for you, you're not ready at this moment, there are other ways you can support us. And one of the most tangible is to go rate this show on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. There are links in the show notes for everything mentioned about 1517 support and ratings. We will catch you next time. Bye.